Awesome to welcome by any means basketball founder Coleman Ayers to the Basketball Podcast. Ayers is the founder of By Any Means Basketball, a global training and media organization dedicated to player development. Launching the brand as a high schooler in Washington, D.C., Coleman turned his passion for skill acquisition and research-backed training into a worldwide movement. After finishing his playing career at St. John's College High School, he chose to forego college basketball opportunities and move to Miami, studied exercise physiology, and began working with players of all levels while building a reputation for blending science, creativity, and culture into modern basketball development. Coleman's approach emphasizes holistic development. His Detail Miami facility serves as a hub for elite training, while his educational platforms, including the Attention to Detail podcast, share insights with coaches and players worldwide. Having worked with athletes in over 35 countries and collaborated with NBA talent, Coleman continues to push boundaries in player development. He is also the co-founder of Adapt Academy. Both of his books, Deep Skill and The Modern Basketball Blueprint, reached number one in Amazon's basketball category.
Hey, Coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group Membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Coleman, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you for having me. I've always been a fan. It's good to finally be on here.
Agreed, finally. Been a fan for a long time as well. Love how you approach things. And I know you talk about blending science and into your training, but one of the things that stands out that I think you do a great job of is creativity. So maybe first talk about blending science and creativity in your training.
With all the science that is now being integrated into just basketball in general, not even only player development, but all realms of basketball, there's a misconception on both sides, but I would say the general misconception is that it is everything and it is a direct roadmap as to how to practically apply things. And I think for me, where that intersection of science and creativity, or the art, I guess you could call it, come into play is using science to inform how you think about things, to spark ideas, to maybe back up some ideas that you've had for a long time, some creative ideas that maybe you don't necessarily, you never really proved with science to yourself yet, but now it can serve as kind of reinforcement. And to me, it's been a constant journey of looking into the science and the research and the depths of this stuff, and then getting onto the court for thousands and thousands of hours purposefully with different types of athletes in different settings, different constraints on myself as a coach to allow that creativity to emerge. And I think it really doesn't happen one without the other. You need the art to really see the science creatively and practically, and then you need the science to best inform your art. And that's something that I'm on a lifelong journey to do.
We both benefited from having permission and freedom. Permission from ourselves and freedom because, again, we run our own brands, we run our own businesses. And we also have a lot of reps with kids that are not like, we're not working with an NBA player getting ready for the championship game. These are low stress, low pressure environments where we get a chance to explore things. Talk to me about the process of, ooh, I like that versus, oh, that didn't work.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, as I alluded to a little bit, I would say the vastness of experiences that I've had as a coach have really shaped how I view and do things. And a lot of that is just, again, being able to experiment, but not only with one team, not only with one setting, not only in one country, across a variety of different settings. And then again, it's a trial and error process. Like, something that works with one group, something that registers with one player, may very well not happen to the next player. And whether that's cultural differences, whether that's just the way that something clicks because of their ingrained movement patterns, whether that's a team that doesn't pick something well just because of the social dynamics, being able to find those patterns and just continuously experiment and do it in a way where it's still productive and enjoyable for athletes versus, again, having super high pressure in high performance settings has been something that's really allowed me to identify these things. And then now when it is a higher pressure, so to speak, situation, I always have a pretty good feeling of what will work and what doesn't, but you need the baseline of those low pressure, just figure it out, trial and error situations.
The undertone of our conversation, coaches, will be, we both use CLA. We'll call it CLA because that's popular now to be able to say it's more than just that. But we're not going to go into any part of that as much as we're going to talk about some of the things that underpin it and some of the things that we've learned from it. But one thing that really stands out from what you've said already is this concept of science, but your experiential learning, your experiential process is what ultimately supports the science back to the coaching. It's not the science told me I'm going to do this. It's the science told me I should try this. And then the experience of trying these things has taught you what you feel work. So the question is, Coleman, how do you know it works?
That is a question that I will be asking myself for my entire life. And this is something that I think everyone should think about from time to time and understand that building basketball players and teams overall is such a multifactorial process that we'll never know what works, right? And I think that's the starting point. When you understand that what you're doing, you may have a really good feeling about it, but you'll never truly know what works. That's what allows you to continuously think more and think deeper, because you may perceive something as working. However, it may not actually be what you're doing that's working, and that will allow you to continue to dive into it. Now, I will say there are some ways that you can get a pretty good feeling for it. Obviously, one is just pattern recognition, what works with certain types of players. And when I say works, what allows you to maybe look at a clip from a year ago with an athlete and be like, wow, this that we have been putting into practice through different small sided games and through different movement challenges looks to my coach's eye to be significantly better. And over time, you develop a coach's eye that you trust. Is it perfect? No, but I think the eye test is one of those things that I've always relied on a good amount in terms of quantifying things. And I always have athletes that come in, hey, can we do a baseline test for my shooting? And then we test it later after a few months and we can see whether I improve. And I'm like, dude, you're just getting better at the drill. If we do 5-spot shooting, you're just getting better at the drill. You're not getting better at it in a truly representative environment. So I think there are a lot of like little eye test based qualities. Feel and adaptability to me are big ones that, again, are not necessarily measurable, at least just yet. But for me, when I see athletes adapt in ways that they haven't done before, maybe re-angle themselves on a drive in a way that's, wow, I have not seen them do that before. Or the confidence to shoot certain shots assertively rather than do so a little bit hesitantly or tentatively. Those are the things that I'm really looking for when, I guess, trying to quantify or measure what works and what doesn't, not just the stats or how well they're doing in a drill.
A great answer. And going deeper with that, like in part because it's showing up against defense in some context,
yes.
Whether it's game, it's repetitions within your training sessions, you're seeing it actually happen against defense. And this is, again, I'm pro everyone because we mentioned at the beginning, it's blending. It's not one thing, it's blending. But 90% of it is probably, it's got to be versus defense to show up in a game. So we want to see it versus defense. So talk to us about that process of doing things guided or live versus defense.
So I always say, and this is something I talked about pretty extensively in the new book that I just put out, is live training, or what I would call like representative practice, is the starting point of everything. That's the bulk of everything. That does not mean, to your point, that on-air practice is bad. It's not at all. It's just a supplement to what we do with the game. And from a coaching standpoint, for me, again, I start almost everything live unless I really know a player and there's a specific reason to not do it. Because, especially in groups, it's so difficult to pick up on whether a player has mastery or not, or what a player is struggling with, if you do not see it in the context of a game. So again, like, I can start everything on air and then build it up to live. But number one, that may be inefficient because they may not need that. They may not need that linear process where it's simple, a little bit more complex, a little bit more complex. Because if they have the option that you eventually get to down already, then you've wasted 15 minutes getting there. So for me, it's starting with the full product, something I like to call play, drill, play, and was not something specific to me that I'm sure a lot of us do, where we start with the game. It allows us to evaluate as a coach. It allows the player to really feel it out with defense in a representative setting. Then if we need to isolate certain qualities on air, whether that's building coordination, just allowing for more volume, to accumulate more volume with a specific type of shot, targeting a specific quality, we have done that now for an educated reason, versus just arbitrarily throwing out an on-air drill that we think will work. And for the player, they have so much more buy-in to that on-air drill now because they've seen how it can apply back to the game, which is the last step in putting it back into the game. So for me, that play drill play is money. I love using that as a staple. Many times it's play, where you start with the game, maybe you simplify it a little bit, but it's still in the context of defense. But again, I do think on-air training can be very valuable as long as it's a supplement to the game, not a replacement for it.
I've heard you talk about this and agree, obviously, perception being a separator, the good from the great. So talk to us about training perception. And incidentally, when we talk about the science is 100% on board with this, but it's a much farther leap for coaches to understand that it's actually perception that transfers more from practice to games than any type of biomechanical technique we talk about. So let's go down that perception rabbit hole.
Yeah, 100%. So I think one of the ways that I've been, I guess, getting some buy-in on this recently is acknowledging how skilled players are these days. And when we just talk about raw skill, ability to control the ball, ability to make shots at an extremely high level, you go down to youth basketball, you cannot get away anymore with just being skilled and being able to do cool things with the basketball like you would be able to even 5-10 years ago, where you had those youth basketball players or even the pro basketball players who were just bigger, more skilled, right? And now the separator needs to be something more, which obviously is always going to be physical, psychological, but perceptual is the one that I've identified to be the strongest separator. Because if you take 15 players at any level, the worst one and the best one are probably going to be able to do pretty similar things on air. What separates them are those little micro adjustments they make in the game, are those little changes that they make tactically to respond to the defense. It's how they manipulate the floor. And again, like, these things are driven by perception. They're driven by how they are seeing the defense, whether that's a super quick decision or whether that's a more well thought out decision, manipulating spacing. But these are the things that really allow players to apply all the quote unquote raw skill into the game. And as you mentioned, like, this is not only the lowest hanging fruit where it's just not worked on much, so we get better results or tend to get better results with it, versus like just continuing to hammer the nail into technique that has been hammered over and over again. There's a bigger nail over somewhere else that has not been hammered enough yet. And that is the perception and how that relates to them executing those skills. So again, like, the research shows it, but more importantly, we've seen extensive results across all the academies that we run and all the different settings that you can imagine with working on this side of things and training in a little bit more representative of a way.
Representative, perception, offense versus defense, whatever we want to go down. But talk to us about player enjoyment and satisfaction of training. Because again, you've been around a lot of situations, and the players you coach have been around a lot of situations where it's just like a completely different experience when, say, they trained with someone else and now they come train with you. So talk about that impact.
Oh yeah, it's night and day. And I think people understand that young athletes enjoy training against defense more and just hooping. And people typically acknowledge that by going, all right, we're going to do the first half is skill work, 30 minutes of skill work, which is just on air work. And then we'll go the last 20 minutes is competing or whatever. And the two things do not have to be separate, which we understand. But what they don't acknowledge, actually, I don't think they acknowledge it enough, but I think they will in due time and after they experiment with this and see it. But what I don't think people realize and what really has informed or confirmed my opinion of this is like the best players in the world enjoy this stuff more. I've never done this type of stuff with a professional player. I've never heard of anyone who's done this type of stuff that involves competing, defense, constraints that really drive creativity, challenges. And a player has not come back and been like, wow, that was freaking amazing. And I had the chance to be around a couple NBA players this summer in training. And a lot of them, or really all the ones that I was around, pretty much just hooped every day, not just 5-on-5, but set up many small-sided games. They didn't necessarily know what they were doing, like with the constraints-led approach. They had a feeling for it because they're basketball minds. But the reason behind it is I don't want to wake up every day and work my ass off and just do monotonous stuff. I want to hoop because that's what drives, that's why I'm here. Because I'm a competitor, I'm curious about the game, I like trying new things, exploring, playing against defense, and that at the highest level. And if those are the highest level players who all of the juice has been squeezed out of the orange, then younger players who are literally there for fun for the most part until you get to a little bit older of an age, then they probably enjoy it more than the monotonous stuff just as well. I think it's something that spans across all age groups, and it's very visible, it's obvious. It's not just smiles, but it's engagement. It's running to the back of the line to be ready for that next rep quicker rather than having to tell them to do. It's going at game speed, so to speak, without telling them to go at game speed. And again, it's just something that you pick up on as soon as you walk into an environment for the first time that is applying these type of things.
I love that you put game speed in quotations because I'm the same. It's like everyone says game speed, they actually mean full intensity, but game speed is not full intensity, and game speed doesn't mean you get to shoot it every time you touch it. And that's one of the ideas of creating these representative environments. Such a great example. Thank you for sharing that. Now, a phrasing that came, I learned from you is kind candor. Talk about that because I love that phrasing.
Yeah, for sure. So that's something, I think I actually took that from Gary Vee, funny enough. And to me, that's just the idea that whether this is in your relationships with like your business, with your personal relationships or with athletes, finding the balance between being direct, being transparent, being honest, but also doing so in a thoughtful way is extremely important. And people enjoy saying, hey, I'm a very direct person, I'm gonna tell you how it is. And they just use that as an excuse to deliver you something in a very not well thought out way. And I've experimented with that type, it's just not me, that type of communication. And I think that's something I've worked on extensively over the years. In this context, we'll talk about athletes, but being able to have honest conversations with athletes and tell them what they need to hear, but do it in a way that still responds well to how they think about things and maybe the emotions that they're going through. And so many coaches tend to, again, use that as a cop-out of just, I'm a direct person, you got to deal with how I tell you things. And it's, you don't consider all the emotional baggage that athletes are carrying into every given day. And if you're just delivering it based on your personal communication style, you are doing them a disservice. So again, it's not something that I'm perfect at yet. Sometimes I'm too kind, sometimes it's too much candor. But I think if you find that balance where you're honest, but do it in a thoughtful way, and that thoughtful way is different for every athlete, that's where you can really find like quality communication as a coach.
Well, I love the approach. I love the phrasing of it and the mindset behind it. And we both use small-sided games. And I think it's at the point now, again, CLA, small site games, they're not new, but we're at the point now that people are diving deeper into kind of a little bit of the history, the background, et cetera, of it. But one of the things that I want to ask you about, we both deal with this, is the challenges of using small sided games. It seems great. Just, okay, let's use the small site games. Coach Oliver, Coach Ayer said, hey, we should use more small sided games so people use them. But there's some challenges to them. So let's talk about some of those.
Yeah, 100%. Especially as I've gotten more into educating coaches, which is what I spend a lot of my time on now, especially this time of year, I see some pretty common patterns. And it's not a bad thing, right? Like it's better to just get started and then figure it out than trying to be perfect. So I'll list off a few of the bigger ones that I see. Number one is not considering the advantage in the game that's built into the game, right? A lot of coaches will start with either a crazy advantage where there might as well be no defense, or probably a little bit more commonly, no advantage, right? And this is in a team setting where obviously if you don't have an advantage, then you have to rely on advantage creation, which means you're probably not working on being able to play with dominoes and with an advantage, maintaining and finishing an advantage. But in a player development setting, I see so many coaches and even athletes where it's like, they want to work on their finishing, but they start with a defender in front of them and have three dribbles. And many times they don't even get to the rim. And obviously that's an exaggerated example, but I see it quite often. And understanding how the advantages affect the entire outcome of that player development or team development process is extremely important. And something that, again, you start to pick up over time, but maybe needs to be called out a little bit here and there early on in your journey. I also think people don't understand what constraints actually are, and this may be reverting a little bit back. They don't understand what the CLA actually is, right? Where small-sided games is not the CLA, and CLA is not small-sided games. You can run small-sided games without seeing it through the lens that is the CLA, which is basically, hey, go play this game. The CLA is utilizing what you could just consider to be rules at its simplest sense, or different incentives to shape the game as you would like to, or shape the environment, the task, whatever the case may be. Case in point here, the CLA is also very useful for on-air tasks and drills, right? We can use the CLA to build fluidity in a jump shot by setting the constraint that an athlete cannot jump off the ground when they shoot. We can use, for example, earlier today, I was working with a player on like their short jumper game and telling them, hey, you have to jump from one side of the line to the other side and shoot it in midair. Okay, very simple constraint. But now instead of telling them, hey, kick this right foot up and really diving into the technique, it's like, all right, I'm giving you a problem that you have to solve, and I'm adding different rules to make this problem the exact way that I want it to be. And with that, people don't realize the effects of the constraints that they actually do put on it. There are a lot of indirect little effects of the constraints. Case in point, and a very common one, is people always like to restrict dribbles significantly because we think less dribbles, more efficiency. Great. But if we want to work on finishing at the rim and there's no advantage, and we say two dribbles to finish at the rim, now they're going to be approaching it out of control. They don't keep their dribble alive. That's something that, again, maybe we wanted to work on. And there's so many different, I guess, outcomes from one little constraint that people don't consider. So there are all these little things. Again, I could go on with adding too many constraints. I see a lot of coaches who have four or five constraints to every drill. And then now the athlete, all of their attentional currency is going towards remembering the constraints versus actually hooping and executing the game. So there are so many different effects. And these are things that, like, you start to pick up on the nervous system aspect of it, understanding like how demanding the games are, the spatial constraints. So that is probably the biggest struggle, is that it's just too... it's not hashed out enough in people's minds yet as to actually how they can control their environment. But once people start to understand and like just have this feel, I don't know about you, but for me, it's just like a feel thing where you can, it's hard to explain to coaches and articulate it. But once you start really getting creative with it, you're like, oh shoot, I never thought about this part.
It's hard to articulate it, agreed. But when they see it, they get it. And yes, that's the thing. And I love that you said this, but like CLA is not just add defense. CLA can be done in a one-on-one workout. And absolutely, that's the thing that I think people are not connecting. So I'm glad you went there as well. And the dribble thing just destroys youth basketball. When we do all these drills with dribble constraints and then kids pick up the ball without a decision, learning how to get to space with your dribble is the key part of all that. But anyways, I want to go back. Unrealistic advantage. When I did some CLA stuff with an NBA coach, that was one of the first things we went to discuss deeper, is like giving too big an advantage, too little an advantage, and how to manipulate that. So maybe talk about that first, and then I have one or more question about kind of these unrealistic things.
Yeah. So I consider there to be three general categories of advantages. You have half, full, and none. All of them are useful for different types of, or different focuses. Half, actually, I'll start with none. No advantage is defenders in front playing essentially one-on-one. Full is defenders behind. So in a game situation, this could be, you come off of a ball screen, you have a full advantage if you are holding off your defender who went over that screen. Half advantage is hip to hip, shoulder to shoulder. You maybe beat someone off the dribble, and as a result, they're still in the picture, but you do have a little bit of clear space in front of you. So at its simplest, understanding this is very important. Again, we want to, if we're working on finishing, create maybe a half advantage or a full advantage, depending on what the athlete needs and what the task is. So maybe if there's no help defense, a half advantage may be better. If there is help defense, a full advantage may be better. If it's more challenging coordination wise and they need a little bit more time and more of a window of space to figure out this finish, maybe we give them a full advantage. So there are plenty of applications that come from this. And then you start to think about how this advantage is created and you go down another rabbit hole where it's like, again, it's not just starting statically in these positions, but sometimes the most traditional one is ball on back. If you allow the defender to look behind them, it will most times end up in a half advantage. If you don't allow them to look behind them, it will most times end up in a full advantage. And then you can create it different ways. I'll constrain the defense by having their arms behind their back. So maybe you start with a full advantage, but it's hard to move with your hands behind your back. So you end up with a full advantage or a half advantage. It's not an X to Y direct correlation between when and where to use any of these advantages, but just getting creative with how to do it, understanding what the real purpose and goal of the drill is, and not just adding complexity with no advantage every time, is something that's helped our coaches take their coaching to a new level for sure.
Love that. And unrealistic starts is the other one for me. I get it. Sometimes at camps, like we have to start some advantage drill from the baseline up just for safety and numbers, but we're not talking that. And coaches, there's tons of like great advantage drills online that if you just change where they start, they become more realistic, for example. So like dribbling from the baseline up with a player beside me, I'm like, when would that ever happen in a game type of thing is what you should always be asking. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on unrealistic starts.
I think especially as you get with older, more experienced players, and as you get into the season when specificity kind of reigns supreme, it is very important to consider how the advantages are being created and where on the court the advantages are being created as well. How meaning, hey, if a player comes off a ball screen every time and that's how their advantages are often created, we should probably have them curving, even if that's not coming off of a ball screen, but maybe curving into it. Another consideration here is perception and vision with advantages. So many times, and I'm sure you've seen and thought about this extensively, but players are sitting there dribbling, perceiving the entire floor, predicting what they're about to do versus just flipping them the other way. Now they're looking at half court, and when they turn, it's a whole world in front of them that they have not perceived and understood yet. So starting them sometimes with limited vision, sometimes, again, players who are maybe like athletic slashers, if you only start them in practice with a static advantage, maybe at the three-point line, you're not really generating the level of speed, chaos, and aggression that they play with in a game. So maybe having them start at half court, get a full running start and start an attacking or a small sided game that way is a very important consideration. So it's where on the court, it's how they're creating the advantages. There are times, especially like in warmups and stuff like that, where we'll look to build more general qualities with the advantages. If you're working with younger athletes, we'll start them on the ground sometimes and say, you got to stand up as quick as you can and get into it, because we're just building general coordination, movement quality. It's a fun warm up. We'll have them go under hurdles to get really low or jump over a hurdle. So adding some different chaos and movement challenges, especially in the off season or in specific situations where we want to build those movement qualities, but specificity and just understanding all the implications and what limitations you may be experiencing with a very simple advantage is extremely important. That's the next level of how you start thinking about a lot of this stuff once you get the experience.
You're getting me jazzed up. I love this stuff. I love it. And coaches, you don't have to keep the same advantage for the whole drill or for each player. Hey, coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you really know which plays, sets, and actions are working for your team? On offense, how valuable are paint touches and post entries? On defense, do you get more stops playing man or zone? Like high-level college and pro teams, you can use an analytics system like Hoopsalytics to get data-driven answers to help guide your in-game strategy and practice emphasis. With Hoopsalytics, you can track any action or set and see the resulting points per possession. Plus the video link stats, you can view your successes and fails and see if it's a play design or execution issue. And you can easily build organized film sessions from these video clips. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free. And Coleman brought up a great point, which is you don't want to have too many things that they have to think about, because then they're not playing freely, and they're not solving problems in the same way. But that was great. Another thing that comes up as you're talking is this concept of the unrealistic movements, that sometimes we constrain players to the point that they're doing things unrealistically with their movements. I say ball, your hands behind your back on defense, for example. I understand the value of it, and I'm not saying it's wrong to do it. I'm not saying that. But if you do it all the time, then they don't learn how their hands actually help them move their body, for example. So I'm sure you've thought about things like that. Can you talk a little bit about constraining them too much with these unrealistic movements?
So I'll speak to this through the context of defense, which is what you just mentioned with the hands behind the back. Number one, to preface this, I think this is a hidden in a weird way. I don't think it should be hidden, but I don't think people realize it enough, like how good it is to use small-sided games for defense and how much you can build really quality defenders without even thinking about it much. But that requires you thinking about both sides of the equation there, right? As you mentioned, yes, we need to think about what this defense does for the offense, or what this defensive constraint does for the offense, whether they're holding a ball over their head, whether they are starting with their hand on the ground, which is one that I'll use to create an advantage sometimes. Again, the list could go on for thousands of these, but you also have to think about the effect of the defense, which is the other 50% of the game. And I've noticed team coaches are more readily thinking about this than player development coaches, which I try to encourage them to think more about, because again, there's so much that you can get out of the other side of the ball with small sided games, and you can intentionally cue and incentivize the defense so that every single rep isn't just offense getting practice on a live body. It's offense getting practice and defense getting practice. And again, how that ties back into what you mentioned is don't just do everything for the sake of offense. Don't create non-transferable practice settings and environments for the defense just for the offense. You can get creative enough to get both a really good result. And that includes varying the constraints of the defense and building more adaptable defenders who can defend with a ball over their head or with one arm or in wider spaces than they should. But don't skip by a lot of these things. And then even offensively, really just think about everything that you add to it constraint-wise, but also everything that you leave by not saying anything. And there are so many different things that when we don't mention things and we don't set certain constraints, which happens to me a lot because I try to be I don't want to speak too much and I don't want to be as wordy as maybe some coaches are, but at times I'll leave certain things on the table by not giving a quick cue that could change something and make it more of a representative movement or environment. So it's very important. There's a lot going on, especially as you get to like higher numbered games, 2v3s, 3v3s, and there's just so many like moving pieces and dynamics that you have to think about if you really want to get the best result out of every athlete on the floor.
It reminds me, I just had a conversation with a parent on the weekend about their daughter improving their ability to go to their weak hand because they're so dominant with their strong hand. And she suggested something a little bit, because she knew the brand, about like constraints for the girl to say, oh, you can only go to your weak hand. And I'm like, no, we got to think about it the other way, which is, can we constrain the defense so the defense doesn't let her go there, is much more powerful for her learning how to solve problems. And to the point that I've done that with my oldest daughter, who's a lefty, and gone to coaches that I know who we play against and said, in advance, text them and say, don't let her go left.
Nice.
Can you do something? And people think that's crazy, but I'm like, if it's about development, it's not crazy, is it?
No, that's part of it, man. And that's the other thing that I don't think people realize about seeing things through this lens is, especially in youth basketball, or how youth basketball should be, the game can, we can breed constraints through the game just like we do in our practice, right? And this is something we really approach our program Adapt Academy, and some of our coaches who coach in high school as well, or middle school. High school, sometimes you can't set some of these constraints, but you can set constraints for players. It can be as simple as, hey, I need you to get 5 rebounds, which is the old traditional constraint. But it could also be like, hey, if we don't do this, then I'm going to restrain you guys to this. And there's so many different ways that you can see the game, which is truly the most representative environment that you can ever imagine as practice. And again, if you can't really do that if you want to win every game and win every game by the maximum amount of points, but that's the problem with our youth basketball landscape right now, is that we're not willing to do this.
You and I will have that conversation another day. People hear that enough for me, but there are, like, there's just beautiful fixes, and you gave some examples. And ultimately what this all comes back to, and I want you to talk about that, because I know that's a big part of your brand, By Any Means Basketball, and your books, is this concept of adaptability. And we're trying to develop adaptable players, not repeatable players, in some context. And talk to us about that.
So over time, I've been asked the question over and over again, what are the most important qualities of players? And I never really had an answer until I just kept saying things that were different ways to explain adaptability in different parts of the game. And to me, again, yes, it is important to have a base of anything, even psychologically, having core values that you can come down to and always hold strong to, and having a shooting technique that doesn't vary significantly from shot to shot in an open, blocked environment. However, past that initial level, which I think most people overestimate how long it takes to set that foundation, which is a very important component of this, adaptability is the most important. And we have a few different types of adaptability. You could talk about, like, movement adaptability. In other words, your ability to maybe hit a weird position, even outside of the context of the ball, like defensively, can you get a little bit off balance and then regain balance and be explosive from there? We have skill adaptability, which comes down to things that you can do with the ball in the context of the defense. Can you, again, go up in the air and make a quick reaction when a defender tries to block from your right hand and you switch to the left hand and find a new angle all in three tenths of a second? Shooting wise, can you deal with the inherent motor noise that goes on in your system and adjust the release at the last second to be a little bit higher while you're fading a little bit, shoot a little bit to the left? And again, these aren't things that we think about, but they're things that come with experience and repetition without repetition. We have tactical adaptability, which is being able to read the defense and all the different coverages that they may provide you, all the different problems that they may provide you with in a given play, in a given situation, and then solve those in different ways. We got role adaptability, which is being able to play one role on one team, maybe your high school team, and then switch it over and play one role with an AU team. Or if you're a professional, going from one team to another and being able to mold yourself to that system. And then social and psychological adaptability as well, where you're able to interact with new people, where you're able to deal with the ups and downs of every game and every year in a way that, again, isn't just super rigid to how you do things. And when you take all of that and put it into a bucket, that bucket being adaptability, it's hard to say that is not the most important skill or quality in basketball. And when you look at across the board how all of those are developed, it's done through being in situations, solving problems that are difficult to you and that require you to do that in a different way every time.
Such a key part of that is just putting them in problem-solving situations and trusting that's going to help them. And that's requires some bravery for coaches that haven't experienced it before. And I know you've been around that with some of the different events you've done, some of the sharing you've done. Coaches that are exploring these ideas for the first time, what is some advice to those coaches that they know they've got to go to some CLA, or they've got to go to more game-based or more small-side games? What is some advice we can give them?
One of the pieces of advice is the one that you just mentioned, which is just trusting and playing the long game. It is difficult, and I still experience this at times, where as much as I talk about letting them figure it out, guided discovery, providing them with problems and not over helping them through that, I will still find myself trying to over help them because I care about the athlete and I care about them figuring it out and winning and being the best that they can. And it's a complete mindset shift to understand that you are not the one who's teaching these athletes. And it's an ego hit at first, because especially when you start with the mindset and go through a decade of coaching with the mindset or more that I am teaching these athletes in the same way that a teacher writes stuff on the whiteboard and teaches to the students. But in reality, as everyone knows, at least in America, how we do school is not the best way for kids to learn. Everyone would agree with that. You need to be in more problem-solving environments. You need more experience with stuff. And once you make that mindset shift to understand that, hey, I can be the person to set up these environments with these athletes, and I can help them a little bit and nudge them and guide them in the right directions. But the environments I set up and the environments that I have no part in are the ones that are truly responsible for them developing and improving. That has big implications in how you coach. And again, it's not an easy thing to do, but you need to start taking pride in setting up environments over delivering teaching points that you think are going to be applied, because they are not. And if they are applied, it's only being applied when they see that problem next and when they're able to solve the problem at some point. And that's what we talked about at the beginning. Do we really know what is working? Is it really you teaching them these things, or is it you just showing it to them one time and then the next day they go and do it with their buddy in a 1v1? It's probably the latter. And you need to embrace that, not shy away from it. And that's probably the biggest, like, overarching piece of advice I would say for just a big mindset shift when people start to get into this.
Great advice. And if the athlete is struggling, and I say this all the time, this is back to our blending that we started with, it's, you don't have to not coach them. Sometimes you can speed up the process, but generally, again, from my perspective, I'd love to hear yours. I'm always going to start with a question rather than giving an answer. Any other advice in that way, when they are struggling and you do need to help them in some context to speed up the process, how do you approach it?
Yeah. So my goal is to never make them feel as if I gave them the answer. I want them to feel as though they came up with the answer. And doing that is a delicate process, and you don't learn how to do that as a coach in a couple of days. It comes with a lot of trial and error, but general process there is, again, as you mentioned, same thing as you, start with a question, right? If they're struggling to make a shot, it's, hey, what are you feeling? What do you think is going on here? Or even just like approaching it from a psychological standpoint, what's going through your mind right now? And then you go from there, you continue to ask questions, you continue to ask why. And sometimes the questions can essentially be you telling them something, but rephrased as a question if you need to get there. Don't need to overcomplicate it and sit there and interview them or interrogate them for an hour, but you can start to make them feel as though they are the leaders of their own learning versus they are dependent on you to teach them everything. And that, again, goes past the implicit learning side of things, where when an athlete learns something that they don't necessarily think about too extensively or too internally, it is probably going to transfer and they're going to retain that information better. But it's also just the mental model of how they approach basketball. If they always are going to be reliant on a coach, on you, on their parents, then they're always going to be looking in the stands during the game for you. And they're not going to be autonomously solving problems, which is really the core of what adaptability is, right? So we are limiting athletes' adaptability. We are not taking advantage of opportunities for them to learn how to learn when we over-communicate, when we give them the answer versus leading them to that through guided questioning, guided discovery. And there are plenty of ways to do that, whether just showing them something, demonstrating, having another athlete teach them rather than us teach them, or just sometimes giving them a small cue, an analogy here and there, and letting them figure it out and allowing the process to take longer.
I know one of the things that you're spending more time on is thinking about the entire process of building out team and player development plans. So talk to us about where your mind's going with some of that, because I think that is, again, it's a level that most people aren't getting to, and we're not getting to yet as a whole. And I think that's where comprehension will increase for people when you're putting it together in this context.
Yes, absolutely. I think the biggest, to again preface this based on what you said, like, it's easier to throw out small-sided games, even to run really quality small-sided games, but do it outside of the context of need and a long-term development plan. What's very difficult is to align those things and really think on a daily basis about what each athlete needs, right? So for me, a lot of these like player development plans that we build, whether that's us individually for a player, helping teams do it, or doing it with our teams, whatever. A lot of this comes down to the what, the how, and the when, right? The what is understanding what the athlete needs to work on. Most of this for us comes down to rate limiters and superpowers. So again, this can be with the team, understanding where they struggle to create advantages, where they struggle to prevent advantages defensively or recover from advantages defensively. For a player, obviously, the common rate limiters, which are, by the way, just the things that keep you off the floor for the most part, the things that prevent you from going from 15 minutes a game or 10 minutes a game to 30 minutes a game. These can be things like defense and lack of shooting ability, handling pressure, but understanding these rate limiters first is extremely important because these are the things that no matter how good you are as a team or as a player, they're going to stop you. And then the superpowers are the things that each individual athlete or each team is meant to do. It's what is going to keep them on the floor as a player. It's what's going to make them, that's their claim to fame. And this is many times ingrained in a player from a young age, whether it's natural or whether it just developed in early childhood based on all the individual and environmental constraints that took place on them. Most athletes have at least something on the court that they just feel like a natural at. And those are the superpowers. Those are the things that are going to make you a hallmark player in some form or fashion. So that's the what. We need to understand what those things are, not to get too detailed into the when and the how, but then it's about understanding when to work on these things. It's easy or it's tempting to look at the superpowers and the flashier things and the more advanced things and say, hey, I want to work on those things with this team. But then sometimes you got to scale it back and be like, all right, what's the rate limiter here? They may be fantastic at playing once they have an advantage, but they really struggle to create an advantage off of, like, with physicality, through physicality on ball screens or different two-man actions. So that may be the only focus for a couple weeks because we may never see how good they are at basketball without fixing that. And then with the player, same thing, like they may be the best shooter on earth. And this is honestly me as a kid, which is why I see it. Like, I was a fantastic shooter, 50% shooter from three, but I couldn't play defense to save my life. So I never got to showcase that. And everyone has their example of that, but and sometimes it's not as exaggerated, but we need to understand those and then build the superpowers. And then also, like, in the context of a season or an off season, understanding when we need to be more exploratory, trying things that are extra to their game, and then when we need to be more specific. So doing the things that are extremely representative of their game. And then the how is pretty much everything we've talked about, the games that you actually use. And usually that's pretty easy to pencil in once you have the framework on top of that.
Accounting for individual differences is such a huge part of what you're sharing here, this part in particular. But it just strikes me, like, I remember we had a European big when I was assistant coach in college, one of my first college coaching stops. And our head coach was always getting frustrated that this European big wasn't, like, physical and tough and dominant. But you know what? He's a really good shooter and he could shoot the crap out of the ball and he was good enough defensively and all that. But it's like we try and put people, and that's the problem with kind of the cookie cutter approach to coaching, is we try and put people all in the same bucket and they're different buckets. And what you just explained in terms of these processes, these plans, is understanding that they can be in different buckets and still succeed and still be beneficial for them and for the team.
And those individual differences, again, and this is something you mentioned a little bit earlier briefly, is we can account for these within each game. It doesn't have to be in the player development section of a practice, like everyone's going through the same thing. No, we can give each athlete different constraints or different starts. I was with an NBA team recently and three completely different types of players getting their post-practice shots up. And again, typically it's the thought process, they're just getting their shots up. Like it applies to everyone, but it's like, no, why not slightly individualize, just add a small little constraint to each one to make sure that they're getting more out of this. Even tactically, like, why don't we embrace these individual differences and allow our team to play with more adaptability than just funneling everyone into the right or into the same thing rather. So yeah, that's something that again is one of those like next level thought processes, but as you get more into this stuff, like it becomes so enticing, so fun to experiment with.
But shout out to the NBA, because generally the NBA pregame workout stuff has really shifted significantly. I assume you feel that way as well, that over the last 5 years, especially, there's so much more guided defense decisions rather than the rote memorization type of reps going on.
Oh yeah. No. And it's, things are definitely shifting. NBA for sure. You hear a lot of these terms very frequently now, which is cool. I don't think people fully understand how to use it yet, but that's coming. College is a little bit different.
Do you feel similar to like analytics? Like at the beginning of analytics, we would throw out some terms and stuff, but I didn't really know what they meant yet. But True. That's what I'm supposed to say. And as people understand more and you keep educating people, I think it'll come, their deeper understanding.
Yes, 100%. I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I know we both are, but we'll continue to evolve and push the needle. Okay. You run a successful brand. And I always think this is important. There's so many trainers, so many coaches that have their own brands or have their own social media. So I'd love for you to share some insights from, not necessarily, again, the history of it, but more some of the insights about what can help someone develop their personal brand more in the context of basketball and sharing and just building the business.
So for me, and this is something I actually had a conversation with one of our coaches, by any means coaches, about last night. And I never really fully made it intentional, but I realized it was at the core of how I've done things over the last, whatever, decade or so. And my content creation, so to speak, process has always just been an extension of my learning and what I've experimented with, continuing to push boundaries. I don't look to post content. I look to post content to share really cool stuff, or at least what I perceive as really cool stuff that I have learned and experimented with recently. And that's, those two motives may seem somewhat similar, but to me, it's everything, right? When you post content with the intention of going viral and being the next big coach, you really limit how much you're learning because you establish yourself as, I'm this guy, I do this things this way. And you also tend to post the same stuff as everyone else versus waking up every day and trying to learn and trying to innovate and be a better version of you as a coach, and then posting what you have learned about those things and posting thoughts from that process. So for me, that's always my biggest advice, I would say, is to like really allow learning to drive your process. And then on top of that, like as you start to build, grow a team around you, have people, whether they work for you or whether they're just like people that you're close with, having a bigger reach allows you to obviously reach more people, but also be impacted by more people and have more of these conversations where people can challenge you and where you guys can innovate and come up with ideas. And to me, like having a full team of coaches under By Any Means, where we talk every single day and really push the limits, that's something that's helped a lot, even in the last couple of years, and has, I would say, like really not only solidified a framework in my mind, but also pushed the practical application side of things every single day.
You appear, again, from the outside looking in, that you're not afraid to share your good stuff either. This isn't, I'm just going to share this random thing. I remember these Nike clinics back in the day, and I felt all these college coaches that had to do the clinic. They just went in, they did the same presentation all the time. And when you watch their team play, they didn't even do most of this stuff, or I never saw any part of it. It was just a clinic presentation. But you authentically share what you do and what you feel is valuable. And that's a big part of sharing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, man. And I've thought about that a couple times when other people have prompted me to, were like, man, don't share your best sauce, man. That's the stuff that you really got to monetize. And I'm like, I don't know how this stuff works, but at some point it's going to work itself out, where if I just share the best, hopefully, that I have to offer, things will go in the right direction. So I've never been afraid of that at all.
I'm with you on that. And also, I know, oh, you got to do this and this to have a viral video. And I'm like, dude, that's just, I'm going to share authentically what I do and how I do it, and if it works out. And I know it's the same for you. That's the videos that kind of have been incredibly successful are the ones that sometimes you had no idea were even good.
Yeah, no, always.
That's, I
always
thought it was good, but I'm like, man, everyone's getting value out of this. I never thought that for a second.
Oh, yeah.
It's so fun. It is so fun to be in that space and in that process, to be able to share. And then with kind of the business side of things, obviously leads us into the new book, which I haven't had a chance to read yet. I will. I know you're just a great sharer, and this is a way to bring everything together, one-stop shopping, isn't it?
Yeah, man. It's the second book. The first one is a little bit more scientific, philosophical, the more so conceptual. The second one being a little bit more practical, which really lays out like the entire blueprint or framework that we use to lay out these player development plans. And that dives deep into the environment that they grew up in, all the individual constraints that they have, and really goes deeper into CLA and ecological dynamics than just small sided games, as we talked about. So it's always fun. Even my first book, I never thought I was actually going to write a book. I just wrote down my thoughts on paper for a couple of years and was like, shoot, I could use this as a book, and then just refined it. And the second one started pretty similarly, where I was like, all right, I have all these thoughts in my mind. I just need to put it on paper in a framework that makes sense to me. And Next thing, it's a freaking book. Yeah, it was a fun process for sure. And I would suggest anyone should go about the process of writing down all their thoughts and trying to organize them and really see what happens from that and how many challenges come from that to what you may think to be easy to articulate or easy to understand, but may not be as easy as you really think.
And both your books, Deep Skill and Modern Basketball Blueprint, available on Amazon. And Coach, can't encourage you enough to continue and develop more of your understanding of all of these different ideas that Coleman and I share. And Coleman has done a great job on social media sharing as well. Coleman, one last thing. Obviously, you do a great job sharing with coaches. I can't encourage you enough to follow Coleman, but bringing together different types of trainers, and you've been really in that space of being around different types of trainers that may be doing this or not doing this, and bringing them together at different conferences and being together. So talk to us about that kind of event type of space where you've done that and some of the experiences maybe that have come out of it for you.
Throwback to 20, man, I don't even know when this was, maybe 2021. We brought together all different types of coaches, trainers. So strength and conditioning, you could say CLA guys, more traditional guys at every level. And through actually a couple events, one in Miami, one in LA, for player development and team coaches to just expand their knowledge, connect. So that was always incredibly fun. And what we've shifted towards now is coaches retreats, where coaches come in for an entire weekend with us, either in Miami or San Diego. And we go through the whole nine, whether it's learning how to communicate better, getting out of your shell a little bit, obviously the little bit of philosophy behind how we coach, but even more so the practical side of things, getting more confident with how to apply little details behind it. We talk about career and business and really connect. And it's always a fantastic time. Yeah, we have them 2 to 3 times a year. I try to go both coasts, usually Miami, San Diego. Got a one coming up in San Diego in May. Yeah, those are incredible. They're always fun for me as well.
Exciting times. And thank you for being divergent and sharing some of your creativity and some of the different things that have come out of your experiences of trying to shape the game and shape players in a very different way, and which now at some point is going to be very common. And you're a big part of that. So thanks for all you've done for the game.
Appreciate it. Likewise.